solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
You know, sometimes they think that, you know, all organizations, as people go to the top, must become more rational and more sensible, and these people have such power. And I'm like, no, right? They become much more political because there are no right answers to the level of problem that those leaders are grappling with. And it really becomes judgment, but also alliances and support. And, you know, and a related thing that I would hear people say sometimes who took the course, they'd say, I hate politics. And my answer would be, get over it, you know, or be a fatality, you know, because, I have my little jokes about this, Deepak. I'd say, look, if you want to describe it as building alliances in support of getting important things done, if that makes you feel better, you know, by all means, embrace that framing, but don't kid yourself that you don't need to do it.
Welcome to the 45th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. I'm an executive coach and I work with leaders during high stakes transitions, whether it's related to an organization or a leader's career. I feel that just like companies need to be coherent about the two questions, where to play and how to win, in the context of their business strategy, we all need to be clear about our responses to the two questions, where to go and how to grow. I work with leaders to address these two questions, specifically during key points of transition as they go through their journeys. In this podcast series, I talk to leaders from multiple domains, CEOs, sportsmen, artists, thought leaders, and more, on three broad themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. I'm excited to talk about the next guest on the podcast, Professor Michael Watkins. He's a professor of leadership and organizational change at IMD at Lausanne in Switzerland, and he's clearly one of the leading thinkers in the space of leadership onboarding and transition acceleration, and he's been studying this topic for a few decades now. He's just published the book Master Your Next Move, published by Harvard Business Review Press. It's a companion to The First 90 Days, a must-read for leaders who are transitioning contexts. As he says, while First 90 Days was about distilling the key themes that are common across transitions, Master Your Next Move is about identifying the different types of moves and discussing elements that are unique and specific to each transition context. Without further ado, let's dive into the conversation with Professor Michael Watkins. Michael, thank you so much for making the time. Really excited to have you on the Play to Potential podcast.
Delighted to be here, Deepak.
And congratulations on the recently published book, Master Your Next Move. How's the book doing?
It's doing great. It's doing great. It's really gratifying to see it come out. It's, you know, as you know, it's basically a companion to The First 90 Days. So, no, very exciting.
Lovely. We'll get to the book in a couple of minutes, Michael. But before that, in this podcast, I like to inquire about people's journeys. I'd love to maybe start by talking about how you started focusing on transitions in your journey, in your research interests. When did this come about? Talk to us a little bit about how did you stumble upon transitions as an area of focus?
Well, so stumble is not a bad characterization, Deepak. I describe myself sometimes as the accidental guru, right? Because I didn't really set out intending to do this. I was teaching at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. I was a negotiation specialist, decision theorist, game theorist. I was mostly studying international diplomacy, but in my wisdom, I decided to teach a co-teach course on organizational change and started talking to people. And this was sort of the late 90s. And it became obvious to me at some point that there was lots of work that had been done on change and lots of work that had been done on leadership, but virtually nothing about taking a new role and needing to both, you know, get up to speed, go up the learning curve, make these substantial transitions, while in parallel needing to lead change, you know, in at the same time. And this is very challenging, right? So I got interested, right? And that was, you know, the beginnings of it all. And I started doing research with with a colleague named Dan Champa. We wrote a book called Right from the Start that was published in the late 90s. And then I got contacted by Johnson & Johnson to start doing some work with them with leaders in transition and building some programs and coaching some leaders. And it, you know, that was the genesis really of the first 90 days, you know, which was published originally in 2003. And once that book was published, my life was basically taken over by transitions because the book did very well. There was lots of interest in it. And so I became Mr. Transition, whether I kind of wanted to or not. But the good news is it's a fascinating subject and one that continues to keep me very, very interested and occupied.
Got it. And let's start with a basic question, Michael. How should leaders and organizations think about return on investment when it comes to transition support, right? Let me sort of get to the core of it.
Yeah, for sure.
Everybody says they do transitions, you know, we have our programs. But in your experience, what do they not account for or what do they get wrong when they think about getting help around transitions?
No, absolutely, Deepak. So, I mean, I get up on my soapbox pretty regularly and say, you know, organizations should be accelerating everybody taking new roles, whether they're onboarding from the outside, moving inside, because the research shows pretty consistently that you can get people up to speed in about half the time, fully effective in about half the time, if you do the right things, right? The right things meaning providing the right kind of support, using the right sort of frameworks and tools. And so there's just this enormous benefit. And if you multiply that across the many transitions that are going on in organizations, and you know, some of our research has suggested that a quarter or more of leaders are taking new roles in large organizations each year, and that pace is only increasing, that's just, you know, it's a huge benefit at both the individual and the organizational level. And then, of course, you know, there's also pretty good research documenting reductions in derailment rates for things like people onboarding, improvements in retention and engagement if you get people sort of connected to the organization early. So there's, you know, there's a rock solid business case basically for doing this. And it continues to surprise me when organizations don't do it.
Mm-hmm. And in your experience, what are the sort of the nuances of transitions that organizations often miss out when they think about supporting leaders? A lot of them, with the right intent, set up some sort of a program. But what are some of the pieces in your mind which often get missed, which are critical?
Sure. So there's a few different layers to that. I mean, there's organizations that still don't really provide decent onboarding support. You know, they may do the cosmetic stuff, the sign up, the provisioning of people, but they don't really do the work of integrating people into the organization. And so it continues to be for those people a sort of sink or swim, you know, kind of experience to some degree. And that surprises me because, you know, there's been so much attention paid to onboarding and, you know, documentation of the value and thoughts about how best to do that. And so that's kind of astonishing at some level. But then if you look at the broader landscape of transition, there's still many organizations that don't really provide much support for people making significant internal moves. And, you know, again, research I've done shows on average, the amount of support given to internal moves is far lower than that given to people onboarding, regardless of how hard those transitions are. And as we sort of go through increasing competition for high potential talent, organizations are pushing people further faster, which is creating more risk, right, in making those kinds of transitions. But still, there doesn't seem to, the connection doesn't seem to have been made that you should be investing in helping those people be successful. And it's not that hard to do. So, you know, this for me is sort of me up on my soapbox, continuing to try to make the case for, you know, investing in everybody making transitions in organizations.
Mm-hmm. And as a practitioner of transition advisory, one of the pieces I find interesting about this kind of work is it's one of those areas where, you know, when you notice it when it's not there, mm-hmm. but when things are going well, somehow it just feels like, it's not noticed when things are going well, when there's good transition support, but you miss it when it's not there. Yep. So what's been your experience in sort of alerting people to the value of transition support? Have you grappled with this issue?
No, for sure, right? And I think that what's the antidote to that is good research. You know, that basically says, look, yes, you may have people who get it right and just do it naturally, or the situation really is a favorable one, I'm coaching a CEO right now of a big healthcare system in the US, internally promoted, previously the CFO, very accomplished leader. You know, I was brought in basically to by the board to kind of help him make a successful transition. And I'm having to work to find ways to add value to that transition because he's just so good. Now, he still finds it valuable to work with me because I was able to come in and sort of confirm that they put the right foundations in place, you know, interact with the board, reinsure the board, and so on. So he sees value in it, right? But when things, you know, go like that, when you've got a highly accomplished person, it's a transition that's not really huge in some senses because he was kind of playing a leadership role anyway before this, it can become less obvious that that sort of support is really valuable. But for every one of those, there are a dozen where people just really struggle and they struggle unnecessarily. And in some cases, they fail. So, you know, anecdotes are always dangerous, Deepak. The antidote is to look across, you know, the landscape and say, on average, what does the impact of this bring to you as an organization if you decide to make the investment in doing it?
But even going back to that health system CEO that you're working with, Michael, just to maybe stay with it for a couple of minutes, with highly accomplished leaders who have good people skills, who can read, the political context well, have relationships and so on. In those instances, what's the delta value add that a transition coach like you brings? What are the axes of value add? Just to sort of tease out the nuances here.
Yeah, no, for sure. It's a great question, right? And I think there are circumstances in which it's very modest, the value that you add. Although what I'm finding in these situations is that even for people in the scenario you described, as they take on, for example, a CEO role, they really do discover that they don't have many places to go to have conversations, take advice. They discover pretty quickly that there are still skill sets. You know, maybe it's managing the board, maybe it's managing external stakeholders that they haven't fully developed. And so it's really, really rare that I don't find I can add, you know, more value than what they're paying for the service. But sometimes it's more subtle, I guess, and sometimes it's just more obvious what the work is that you need to do.
Got it. And coming back to the books you've written, Michael, you spoke about The First 90 Days and Master Your Next Move. Talk to us a little bit about your journey in writing those books and just the evolution of your thinking process, which led to these books.
Yeah, for sure. So The First 90 Days was published in 2003 originally. And what I was trying to do there was basically lay out a set of principles and frameworks and tools that would work in any transition that any leader was going through, right? So this is kind of the general principles, the general theory of transition, you know, but to a substantial degree, the reader was left to sort of work through how should I apply those principles given I'm going through this kind of transition, I'm being promoted, or this kind of transition, I'm being onboarded. And I offered some clues to that, but I didn't go very deeply into it. And, you know, in 2012, second edition of The First 90 Days, that was really an update. Because leadership had changed to a degree, technology had changed to a degree, speed, you know, already had become more of an issue. I had learned a bit more, you know, about how to do this. And so there was a pretty substantial upgrade of The First 90 Days, but it was still a set of general principles, you know. And so what I decided to do was kind of I'm an engineer originally, we would say orthogonal, you know, dimension, sort of right angle, is to dive much more deeply into the specific types of transitions that people go through, right? So how do you apply those principles given you're being promoted, or given that you're leading former peers, or given that you've gone from a position of authority to one where it's really all about influence? Or, you know, we can talk about this later, you're in a turnaround scenario or a realignment scenario. So I see the books as very complementary to each other, right? One provides the general principles. The other is a place you can go to say, look, given the kind of transition, or more commonly, the mix of transitions you're going through, how do I really apply those principles in a powerful way?
Got it. And maybe sticking to First 90 Days, Michael, and the common principles that you've observed in transitions, In what ways has your thinking evolved on this subject over the last 15 odd years? What are some of the things that are very different today than they were 15 years back?
So I think that, one reality is that most leaders these days are operating teams that include both direct and indirects and also are virtual. And so how do you assess a team, given that reality? And it's just quite different than, in quotes, the good old days when people were, for example, strongly co-located with each other would be one example. I think another example would be the types of business situations, right? I think my understanding of the demands of being in a turnaround as opposed to a realignment, as opposed to a sustaining success situation, became much deeper as I was working with leaders. I guess the third example would be the whole notion of early wins and what do those wins mean and how do what you do to get wins differ in different kinds of situations. Probably a much deeper understanding of culture, Deepak, and how in almost any transition you can imagine, culture plays some role, right? And needs to be considered. So those would be some examples.
Got it. So let's dive into some of these themes that you talk about in the book, Master Your Next Move, Michael.
Sure.
I guess the first question I wanted to ask you even before getting into the themes was, what I notice with leaders when they get into a new situation is they just get consumed by the hose, by the sort of the fire hose that hits them, right? They're just thrown into the deep end and there's a bunch of things that hit them. What's been your experience in leaders creating the mind space to be thoughtful about transitions as they settle in?
It's a great question, Deepak. And I think that it's one reason that I believe it's so critical to start working with leaders early in their transitions before they get too deeply in, because often they end up in this situation where they feel like they're too busy to plan their transition, and too busy to plan your transition is a potential death spiral. So you don't want to do that. And so, at the same time, transition support shouldn't be something extra you need to do. It should make you more efficient. It should help you gain deeper insight. And so what I find is if you start working with people early, ideally before they're even in the role, you can very quickly establish the value of this, that it becomes integral to the transition process and not some extra task that you need to engage in. And that's the biggest point I think I make about this really is that, get going early, focus early, engage in some early planning. And then I think also to your point, even a little bit of popping your head up occasionally and saying, okay, what's going on? Go to the euphemistic balcony and give some thought to it. Check in with your coach, about how things are going. It just lets people crystallize their understandings of what they're up against and begin to be a little bit more planful about what they're trying to do. But what you're describing is a very common reason why people don't get this kind of support. I'm just too busy. And that is a fundamental misunderstanding of the value of getting help to accelerate your transition.
And in your experience, Michael, what's your sense of the transition timeline, right? Do you think about it as 6 months or 9 months or a year? Give us a sense of how we should think about in terms of time.
Yeah, it's a great question again, Deepak, because, obviously I wrote a book called The First 90 Days, right? And occasionally people say, Michael Watkins says transitions take 90 days, right? And of course, I never say that. The first 90 days is about how to use that critical first few months well, right? Now, how far you get in those first few months is going to depend very greatly on the situation. Right? You're in a turnaround situation. You may be, needing to make very hard choices very quickly, change out a team very quickly. You're going to be in a different place after 3 months than someone who's come in more of a sustaining success or realignment kind of scenario. So I tell people don't get hung up on the first 90 days. What I would say, and I think if this gets to your point, is I think a year is a really good time frame, right? Because there's still learning to be done far beyond the first 90 days. And unfortunately, organizations often do sort of provide a lot of support intensively upfront, and then it's nothing, right? And so you know, and so it's like, oh, yeah, and I've got all the support and that was great and fantastic. Oh, where did that all go, right? I'm on my own, you know, good luck and God bless, as we would say, right? So when we structure, for example, our transition coaching engagements, they're always at least 6 to 9 months. And for me, I mean, I coach pretty much exclusively CEOs these days. They are 9 to 12 months, because it really is that long before someone is fully, you know, seated, if you will, in the new role.
And just to get a sense of the themes, if you think about the 9 to 12 months, would you be comfortable talking about what are the headline themes that you sort of address over the duration? Are there,
for sure,
is there a certain seasonality to the way you address different themes at different points in time?
Absolutely. Right now, again, the specifics of the time frame vary, you know, but I love getting engaged with people before they're in the new role, right? So another example, another CEO I'm working with, this was an external hire coming into a, you know, 10 billion revenue, 60,000 employee, you know, organization. He had been a CEO before in previous organizations, but they'd been smaller. So this was a big leap in scale for him. And I got to work with him before he actually got into the new job. And right, so what do you do when you're working with someone coming into the new job? You're helping them plan their learning process, right? What's the technical, cultural, political learning you can do? How can you jumpstart that learning, right, to begin to, you know, get up to speed with the organization? What sorts of connection can you make with key stakeholders beforehand? I often do interviews with some of those people to help, you know, kind of deepen that understanding. And then there's a critical piece about how are you going to arrive in the organization? What's your key messaging coming in? You know, how are you going to begin to connect and communicate? You know, it gets down to the level of detail of, you know, let's look at your calendar for the first, you know, 6 weeks and just talk about where you're going to be, right? And how you're going to basically arrive and show yourself, what your arrival posture, that's the term I use when I work with leaders. What's that going to be? And so with this particular CEO, we spent a lot of time doing that. What's critical in that, Deepak, sometimes, and this, it was very much the case with this CEO, the organization was really trying hard to support his arrival, right? And with the very best of intentions, they had completely filled his calendar, you know, for the first month with stuff, right? And it, so he had a calendar full of stuff. And I said, I sat down and looked at the calendar and said, we're going to rip this up and start over. Right. I mean, with due respect to the organization and with the need, by the way, and we can talk about this later if you want, to build partnerships with people in the organization to support those transitions. I mean, for CEOs, it's communications, it's HR, it's the board. You know, you need a support team, but you also need to really, you know, be somewhat forceful about, you know, deciding how that person is going to, you know, spend those first critical, you know, few weeks in the role. And I shouldn't say, you know, decide, but work with them to really proactively define what they need to do and take control of it early. And then I think the early months are often initially about learning and connecting, right? But again, it depends a lot on how serious the issues are. Team assessment becomes very critical early, right? And so the leader transition quickly merges into thinking about the team transition and, you know, critical roles and people, and are you going to have to make some changes in personnel? And if so, what kind of timing is that going to be? And how are you going to onboard new people into the executive team? How do you want to run the executive team? Is it different than what you did before? So there's a big piece of that. There's a big piece about strategy and vision, right? You know, because typically the leader is coming in and wanting to put in place a new strategy and vision, especially if they're coming in from the outside. So not to belabor this, right, but there is absolutely a logic, you know, and as the person gets more comfortable, I generally then sort of transition into a conversation about leadership development, right? What are the skills and abilities you need to build to become fully effective as the CEO of this organization? So it's sort of that sort of thing, Deepak, and you know, I don't have a, you know, it's day 32, you know, we're going to be in Houston, Texas kind of, you know, logic to it. But there is, to your point, there is a seasonality to the process typically.
Got it. Now, I was curious about a couple of things of the various things you said, Michael. One was the notion of arrival posture. I was quite curious about what you had in mind when you said that. And second was about putting a team together on the client side when you come in to enable your transition. Could you double click on both those?
Sure. So when I say arrival posture, what I mean is that, you know, the organization is straining to try and understand this, you know, who this new leader is and what they represent, right? And so you as the new leader should be helping them do that, right? Which means thinking through what are the key messages you want to send about yourself and your leadership in those first critical few weeks. What signals? I talk a lot about signaling and symbolism. I'll just give you an example, right? So with the CEO I was just talking about, there were small, you know, facilities in the organization that probably no CEO in the history of the company had ever visited, right? Or there were midnight shifts in production facilities that no CEO would ever have shown up for, right? And so if you want to send a signal of inclusiveness without being too, you know, being perceived to be too manipulative about it, you want to be thinking about, well, so maybe I'm going to show up, you know, or maybe I'm going to get out in the field and visit some places that haven't normally got attention, right? And in doing so, you can send some signals about yourself and your leadership. And, you know, I'm not saying do things that are inauthentic by any means, right? But help people understand you. That's something you can do very early, knowing almost nothing really about the organization. Does that help, Deepak? Does that give you a sense of what?
I think that's exactly what I had in, I think that clarifies of, I guess, rather than just showing up, being thoughtful and deliberate about how you want to, you know, how you want people to see you as you arrive.
Absolutely. And then on the transition support team side within the client, you know, I hate the term at some point, but it takes a village to support a new CEO coming on board, right? There's going to be key people in communications that with whom you need to engage. What I find, you know, pretty consistently is it's rare that even the best communications people in organizations have had experience with the communication associated with, you know, a new CEO, and sometimes the current CEO departing in tandem. And how do you sort of manage that so you can add some value there? Although sometimes it's funny, there's another CEO I'm working with, and his head of communications just kind of blew me away recently because she'd been involved with like 6 or 7 CEO transitions. So she just had it absolutely nailed, right? And I was just like, wow, this is wonderful, because they'd really thought about, okay, how are we going to kind of, you know, manage the outgoing CEO's transition, recognition of him, you know, celebration of his accomplishments, and then the incoming CEO, who in this case was an internal promote. And so that's an example, right? You want to forge an alliance with the communications people. You're not telling them how to do your job, their jobs, but you're bringing a set of experience about CEO transition communication that they may not have had. The HR people, typically you want to be engaged because often they're the focal point for onboarding. It's a little funny sometimes because, you know, of course the CHRO or head of HR is part of the leadership team. They're being assessed by the new CEO in some circumstances. So it's much easier if, you know, it's clear that the CHRO is going to remain the CHRO. But then you really want to be forging an alliance with those people, right? So because they're often helping to structure the onboarding plan, right? The board, you want to have an alliance with the board, right? I mean, there's a recent example here where, you know, I was really working with the board to help convince them that they didn't want as long an overlap between the outgoing CEO and the incoming one as they were planning, because in general, I'm not a huge fan of overlaps. And they can really create a lot of complexity. So forging those alliances, having it, you know, seen as a team sport, Deepak, I think is kind of part of how I think about the process.
Got it. Just moving on, Michael, you speak about the notion of personal adaptive challenge for a leader as being a key element in a transition.
Yep.
In my experience, I find that there's significant suboptimality in the way feedback flows back to a leader who's transitioning in.
Yep.
What have you observed in leaders setting up a healthy fit for purpose feedback loop?
Critical.
In terms of, who do they speak to? You know, where should they be sensing from? How should they be framing those conversations? And how much of that is DIY versus using a coach?
Yeah, I think it's easier to do if you've got a coach involved because you've got someone who can, you know, go in there and get that feedback. But just to start with the basic premise, Deepak, that, you know, in general, organizations do a poor job of providing feedback to leaders in new positions, especially when they're brought in from the outside. And why is that? Because there's a sort of sense they have to get their feet, you know, that give them a chance, you know, or a reluctance on the part of, you know, direct reports to kind of give upward feedback, or in the case of the board just may not see, you know, what's going on. And so I'm a huge believer in providing structured feedback after, you know, pick a number, 90 to 120 days, certainly not longer than that. Because that provides some discipline, you know, in the sense of giving some serious structured guidance to the new leader upon which they can act before things have gotten to a point where, you know, there are very serious things going on. And so, you know, can the leader do that themselves? Absolutely. Should they? For sure. But I think it's often better done by, you know, having a coach who can go out and conduct those stakeholder interviews. And my process basically, and probably yours is the same, Deepak, is I do an initial set of stakeholder interviews. And then after 60 to 90 days, I go back and meet the same people, right? So now I've got a little bit of a relationship with them. You know, I can, it just makes it easier to kind of collect the sort of, you know, real feedback about how this person is doing.
So what's the first set of conversation with these stakeholders, Michael, before the leader comes in? I get the 90-day conversation or 90 to 120-day conversation. What's the day zero conversation with these stakeholders?
Sure. So it depends a lot, again, just on that conversation with different types of transitions, whether it's an internal move or an external hire. In both cases, there's a conversation that's sort of almost like a SWAT-like conversation about what's the agenda? What are the challenges? What are the issues? You know, is there a common understanding of those things? And that's obviously something that the leader themselves can do. But surprisingly, an outsider often is able to get insights that it's harder for the leader to get. You know, and it makes no sense if you think about it, but people are often willing to say things to me that I'm not sure they would say to the leader that I'm working with, which is kind of weird, right? But, you know, and partly that's just my reputation and people know I'm not going to give them, you know, provide verbatim comments directly to the leader. I do it thematically. That's another thing is I have a lot of experience, right, in putting together this kind of data. So there's some value, I think, in doing that. For internally promoted people, there's often an additional piece, which is kind of about what do they need to really do to step up in the role. What concerns do you have about them moving into this new role? How do you see them needing to develop themselves to be fully effective in this role? So there's kind of that additional piece. But that's the kind of sort of upfront diagnostic work that I tend to do when we build into our processes. And then, you know, that 60 to 90 day piece is, again, kind of feedback oriented, right? How are things going? What are you going to do more of? What should this person be doing more of, less of, continuing to pursue? You know, that sort of structure.
Got it. Let's dive into some of the specific challenges you talk about in the book, Michael. Let's start with the promotion challenge.
Yep.
And that all of us go through in a corporate journey, right?
Absolutely.
And I'm specifically curious about the transition from functional leadership to general management.
Yep.
I did have a few specific themes here, but in your experience, what are some of the common points of derailment when people move from functional leadership to general management in your experience?
Yeah, I mean, at some level, it's what you'd expect it to be, Deepak, right? I mean, you know, the famous American author, Mark Twain, has a saying I've always liked a lot, which is to a person with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so, you know, if you've come up through a function, there's a tendency to continue to be anchored from a mindset point of view, you know, from an experience and comfort zone point of view to that function. And it takes real discipline to sort of let go of that. I see this in particular. I mean, I'm coaching a female CEO right now who was previously a CFO. Right. And of course, you know, knows the numbers up, down, sideways, very comfortable with it. responsible for managing risk in certain ways of the organization. And in order to be effective as CEO, she's got to give up a lot of that kind of orientation, right? She's got to think about risk differently than she did before. She's got to think about the organization as a whole and its trade-offs and kind of maybe lighten up a little bit on the financial perspective. And she needs to have someone in that CFO role that she trusts, so she's not tempted to kind of become the shadow CFO and rather than the CEO. So that would be one example, right? I think, I did a lot of research and writing specific to this kind of transition. And I wrote an HBR article a few years ago called How Managers Become Leaders that really focuses on what are the major shifts you need to go through in going from being a functional leader to being a general manager. And one of it's what I just mentioned, right? The sort of from being a specialist to being a generalist. But there's also the reality that you have to be integrating across the organization and managing those trade-offs across the organization and representing the enterprise view, which is often something new for someone that's been a functional leader. You need to be, the role model for the organization, right? People are looking to you even more than they did previously for the kinds of leadership behaviors that, you're projecting need to exist in the organization. So it's things like that. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. And maybe, picking up on a few specific themes that came up in that section, you talk about a unit of analysis with mm-hmm. which you engage with your direct reports, yep. and that shifting significantly when you move from one level to another. Yep. Could you talk to the listeners about the insight here?
Sure. So take a simple example, right? You've got someone who was basically a frontline, leader managing a portfolio of projects with a team, right? So what are they doing with that team? They're, working with the team to break down the project into those key pieces and make sure each of those specialists is working on their chunks, right? You go to the next level, you're managing people like that. You're now deciding what projects are going to be pursued and which people are going to be pursuing them, right? So it's, you're now looking at a portfolio of projects. That's your unit of analysis, where previously the unit of analysis might have been more project or task. You go to the top, you may be managing people who actually are responsible for complete businesses. So it's just making sure that you reset your unit of analysis to make sure you're delegating in the right ways, because what looks like effective delegation at one level can look like micromanagement at the next level. So that's basically the caution that I give people.
Got it. And the other theme that I found interesting was you speak about managing in the white spaces when somebody moves from general management, from functional leadership to general management role for the first time. You talk about ensuring that you manage in the white spaces. Yep. What's the insight here, Michael?
Well, so it's very much linked to that notion of the enterprise leader as integrator. You've got to be managing the trade-offs across the enterprise because no one else is going to do it. And likewise, there's going to be issues that arise, challenges that emerge, opportunities that show up that don't kind of fall neatly into any function, right, or any specialty. And so you've got to be the ones, and that's when I say the white space, that's what I mean, right? The stuff that isn't necessarily evident to people in their functional organizations or their businesses or whatever. And you've got to be engaged in scanning the environment and sensing and responding as those sorts of challenges and opportunities arise. That's the basic meaning of the white spaces.
Got it. And the third piece I was curious about is possibly specific to an Indian context, where in general, we all grow up in an environment where there's a certain scarcity of resources at every level.
For sure.
And that leads to a certain competitive streak that's built into the people that come through the system, and that gets hard-coded. And when you sort of juxtapose that with leaders having to transition from being a warrior to a diplomat that you talk about when they move from functional leadership to general management, I find there's some sort of an interesting glass ceiling that a lot of these people hit when they get there. So talk to us a little bit about
it's such a good insight.
How leaders should make that mind shift. At this level, it's not even a skill shift, right? It's about how do you rewire your mindset. So what's been your experience with leaders that do this effectively, Michael?
So I think, first of all, it's a great observation about culture, right? I was sort of smiling as you said that, because we did some work recently for an Indian organization. And, you know, part of it was, it wasn't transition work, it was development work. But, you know, normally we use sort of little case studies to motivate some of what we do. And this organization wanted to set up sort of team versus team competition to see who would do best on the case study analysis, right? And I'd never seen an organization ask for that before. So it gives me a bit of insight into what you're saying, Deepak, about the culture and competitiveness. But the essence of this mindset is to say, look, that, you know, at some point, as you get to senior levels, your ability to move forward depends very strongly on your ability to forge alliances internally and externally. And so if you're locked in a zero-sum competitive mindset, you're going to struggle to do that. And you've got to kind of adjust to a sort of a mindset of abundance, a mindset of possibility, a mindset of alignment, a mindset of reciprocity, and also a recognition that, you know, at the top, organizations depend on strong relationships and alliances to move themselves forward. And certainly as you look into the external environment, the ability to shape the external environment, complex political, social, and other challenges, really rests on your ability to navigate, you know, diplomatically through those thickets. I'll give you a specific example. I'm working with a leader who took on basically the responsibility for a global public health portfolio in a large pharmaceutical company, including multi-drug resistant tuberculosis. You know, and this person had previously been, you know, running commercial, responsibilities for, you know, significant drugs, and that's a very competitive, you know, thing to be doing. And all of a sudden, he was thrust in this environment where there were all these NGOs and governmental agencies, and quasi-governmental agencies. And there was a real kind of shock initially of, oh my goodness, how am I going to do this, right? And the good news with that situation was I do come out of a negotiation and diplomacy background. And that's part of why the chapter on building alliances is in the first 90 days. But it is a mindset shift to begin to think diplomatically, right? To become a corporate diplomat. And I think as you get to the top of organizations, probably as true in India, or maybe as true in India as anywhere, you've got to be able to make that shift.
And in the book, you also talk about the distinction between alliances and relationships.
Yep.
Could you talk to the listeners about what's the nuance here and what people often get wrong here?
Sure. So I could have a wonderful relationship with you, but you may not be willing to support me in doing some very important things that I want to do. And I may have a terrible relationship with you, but there may be narrow things on which we can agree and pursue jointly, right? And so don't assume that a relationship translates into a supportive alliance, and don't assume that the lack of a relationship or even a negative relationship precludes the opportunity to build support to accomplish important things. I mean, that's the essence of it, Deepak. Does that make sense?
Yep, absolutely. And I found the distinction interesting because people often take comfort or invest in relationships, but sometimes they don't have that orientation towards building an alliance from a change perspective, right? In terms of where you're trying to take the organization.
Right. And then they're shocked to discover that those relationships, as good as they may be, don't translate into the kind of support that they thought they would get.
So from that perspective, the distinction was quite interesting. Moving to a different theme you talk about in the book, Michael, leading former peers.
Yep.
And that's, again, something I guess all of us grapple with at various stages in our corporate careers. One of the themes you talk about is relationship reengineering, right? When you start leading your peers, you know, what are some of the key elements for people to bear in mind, and what mistakes, common mistakes, do you see people make here in terms of reworking the relationships?
Yep. So when you're promoted, you know, internally, and let's use going to CEO as an example, right? There's a piece of this that really is about the reality that the people who worked for you previously are not going to be able to have as much access as they used to. the reality that you're now overseeing and evaluating the performance of people who were formerly your peers. So your relationships with them need to change in some significant way. And if you don't sort of embrace that reality, you can get yourself into a lot of trouble. And it can be subtle. It's quite interesting. You know, so again, CEO client I'm working with, internal promote, very accomplished leader, you know, went from being CFO to CEO. And I'm talking, you know, to his general counsel, right, who previously was a peer on the executive team. And she said something very interesting. She said, you know, I caught myself yesterday, you know, this guy, let's call him Anthony, right, made a request for me, of me to do something. And if it had been the previous CEO, I would have snapped to attention and done it. But because I know Anthony and I know, you know, sort of the way he operates, I didn't react in the same ways, right? But then I realized, wait a minute, he's the CEO, right? Doesn't he deserve the same amount of responsiveness as I would give to the previous CEO, right? And so, I mean, it's a small example, but it's an interesting one, yeah? And likewise, you know, I think that the risk of continuing to operate sort of more like a super peer than as a true leader, that can create real problems for people, right? So, I mean, I'm really counseling people, how do you sort of step up? How do you promote yourself? How do you fully occupy that role? And what does that mean, oh, by the way, for the relationships you had before, which almost certainly have to change in some substantial ways?
And you talk about the tightrope between being a Napoleon versus being a super peer in the book as well, right? Which I found interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, and it is a tightrope, right? Because, you know, you don't want to be coming in, you know, thank heavens I'm finally in charge, you know, clear the decks, you know, salute as I go by. But on the other hand, you do have to step up in a way that demonstrates that you're operating from a position of reasonable authority, given the new role you have.
And you also talk about leaders having to be hard on issues and soft on people. I found that distinction quite interesting when they start leading peers. Yeah. And what's the key insight here in terms of how people should think about settling into a role, absolutely, which includes leading several peers?
So one risk you face when you are promoted to lead former peers is that, you know, there may be perceptions that you have favorites, right? That you like this person, you're not crazy about that person, you know, and if that takes hold, it can really politicize, you know, the situation and undercut in substantial ways what you're trying to do. And so the advice that you just mentioned that I give is, one antidote to that is to focus on the business, focus on the issues, focus on being hard on those things and very disciplined around, you know, paying attention to them. And in that way, sort of the issues with the individual people, you know, become somewhat easier to deal with, because it will be more evident that you're not necessarily playing favorites with people. And so that's the essence of that piece of advice.
Got it. And I found one specific example quite interesting. You talk about a cafeteria situation where, you know, you have former peers seated in a certain section of the cafeteria.
Yep.
And the new peers seated elsewhere. What do you do?
Yep.
It sort of brought to life the real conundrum that leaders often face.
Yep.
So using that as a metaphor, what are some of the watch outs in weaning from the old set and breaking into the new set as people get into the situation?
No, and it's a fun little, you know, sort of a thought experiment to think about doing that, right? And I think that the answer almost certainly is, if not immediately, pretty quickly, you should be sitting with your new peers, right? But you need to manage that in a way that's, you know, reasonably deft, unless you want to be sending a different signal, right, intentionally in the organization. But you still want to be acknowledging people. You don't want to be perceived as you know, disconnected or dismissive of that group of people in the process. But this is hard. It's just hard, because I think that, I mean, I was speaking again with, as one of the set of stakeholder interviews I do with one of the CEOs I'm working with, I was talking to one of this person's previous direct reports, right, who now obviously is, you know, one step removed. And it was almost like he was going through a grieving process, right? He loved working with this leader. and he was not going to have as much access as he used to have. And the new person in the role, you know, as his boss, was an interim and maybe not the same necessarily quality or character of person. And so it's there's nothing easy about it, right? It's just really challenging. But at the same time, that new CEO can't afford to kind of give in to the impulse to stay as connected with that group of people as they used to. And I end up having conversations about this all the time, right? Because it's a real struggle.
And what do and leaders that do this effectively as they move from a high touch to maybe a low touch kind of a mode when connecting with the old set of peers, are there a couple of hacks that come to mind? Not that there's a silver bullet here, but I'm curious about how people manage to do this effectively.
Sure. So I think it helps not to make it too abrupt, but also to be very upfront about it. You know, you don't want to just sort of show up one day and, sorry, I can't talk to you anymore, but it's been fun. You know, I've enjoyed it. So I think you can manage the transition a bit more gradually than that. But I think it also doesn't hurt. And in this case, this is what the CEO did, just to kind of acknowledge that this is what's going on and that it's hard. You know, and I think that will help kind of surface, you know, it will move people forward more expeditiously, right? They're still going to have to go through some form of grieving process. And you just need to kind of, I think, understand that and keep it in mind.
I want to move to the next transition you talk about in the book, Michael, corporate diplomacy.
Yep.
And this is something that we grapple with, right? Authority to influence. Yep. And it's possibly also something that's topical as we move from the industrial age to the digital age.
Absolutely.
Clearly, the ability to influence is probably mattering more and more than it did maybe a few decades back.
So there's no question about that statement, right? And especially as we're moving to sort of flatter, more lateral, more network-based organizations, right? The whole importance of leading without authority is unquestionably going up.
I guess I had a slightly orthogonal question here, right? From a CEO thinking about his career perspective, right? Mm-hmm. Often in a large organization, let's say you're running a large plant. I was working with a CEO who'd been brought in to turn around the business. He turned it around in a couple of years, did a good job. Now, his company is considering him for a regional VP role, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And you sort of double click on the role, it's very different, right? It's mm-hmm. sitting in an office. He's a man who likes to, he's an ex-army, French army man, likes to roll up his sleeves, likes the action, likes the shop floor. The big question he's grappling with is, should he even consider it, given that he's historically been best suited for taking charge and delivering business outcomes?
Yep.
So maybe to ask a different question, Michael, in terms of how leaders should think about careers, but specifically focusing on this notion of authority to influence, have you seen leaders walk away from such opportunities? Or maybe the broader question here is, how should people watch out for a promotion, which seems like an elevation, but fundamentally changes the nature of the job, and it might actually be counterintuitively negative?
No, it's such a great question, Deepak. And I mean, you see it in different levels in different ways, right? So there's the example that you just gave. I do a lot of work with a global healthcare company, and they have a lot of operating companies, and, you know, operating company leadership roles they're a lot of fun, right? You're leading a, you know, an opco team of some form, and you're very much engaged with the business. And the next level up is basically a group leadership role. And so you're managing a whole portfolio of operating companies. You're not part of any one of them. And, you know, it's very sought after to get a promotion from being an operating company president, let's say, to being a group leader. But then people get there and kind of go, this isn't really a whole lot of fun, right? I'm not connected in the same way that I was. I'm not sort of active in the same way I was. And why did I do this exactly, right? You sometimes hear people, you know, ask. And so I think that's very much similar to what you're saying. You also see people who, and I've got a very concrete example I'm working with right now, you know, leader, female leader in this case, who was running a country operation for, you know, a large medical device company and very successful, right? The organization was more a kind of traditional country management structure, right? So she had a lot of authority and she's a very dynamic, you know, for a very action-oriented person. And then they put her in a regional strategy role where she had zero, you know, responsibility. And it's a logical, you know, it's a logical way station to even higher levels. But she struggled mightily, right, to with the fact that she didn't have any of the levers to pull that she used to have. So, you know, I think, first of all, that's just the nature of the beast in terms of the transition. Whether or not you decide to do it, look, I think it's very hard for ambitious people to say, ah, okay, you know, I'm gonna, you know, not do something which probably is a prerequisite to getting to even higher levels. But, you know, the people that are strong enough to understand what really moves them, energizes them, should be giving those things very, very hard thought, because it's surprisingly easy, even at senior levels, to make yourself quite unhappy, right, by the choices you make, you know, in aid of thinking that you need to do something to get to higher levels. I know I'm not fully answering your question, Deepak, because it's a complicated question, and it's a great question, but it's complicated.
No, but I like the way you frame it. It's very easy for you to make yourself unhappy, right? It's absolutely. it's such a profound statement, right? It's sometimes going with the flow is not as seamless as you think it is. So I hear you, and I wasn't clearly there are no simple answers here. But I guess the related theme where I was coming from was, as people think about their journeys and their choices, how much of it should be around, let me find a playground where I can play to my potential, versus this is, you know, the rite of passage and let me adapt myself and do whatever it takes to succeed. So I was just curious about your observations on how people think about those two questions versus of, you know, find a playground versus adapt as they go through their journey.
So I think there's an underpinning kind of idea or phenomenon here, right? So I'm quite interested in certain forms of psychotherapy these days, believe it or not. And one of the reasons I'm interested in that is because I, you know, sometimes when I coach people, I begin to kind of come up against the boundaries of therapy almost. And so I needed a way to think about, you know, where does coaching end and therapy begin? And in fact, this led to some interesting relationships. And I've done a few cases now where I've done sort of joint engagements with a therapist, with a leader, with pretty interesting results. The reason I raise this is because there's certain personalities that have, you know, what are sometimes called unrelenting standards built into them, that they just need to continue to push themselves forward, regardless of how unhappy it makes them. And so I think that, and the reason I say this, Deepak, is that sometimes people, I don't think, feel like they have a choice, right? That they have to keep driving themselves forward, regardless of what it does to them, their families, or otherwise. And so to me, the answer to your question is rooted in part in the level of self-awareness and maturity and self-control in a deeper sense that a leader has. And it's only if that's there that they even have the ability to ask the question, you know, could I say no to this? Never mind actually act upon it.
It's a great point. Great point. I hear you. Back to the corporate diplomacy transition, Michael. You talk about influence landscape, yep, right? You talk about mapping the landscape and coming up with an effective strategy. Could you talk about some of the elements here for leaders to think about this in a structured way?
Sure. So you start with the understanding, and I think it's well understood these days, that every organization has informal networks of power and influence, and that people have power that may not necessarily be obvious at the outset, and that may be rooted in their control of resources, it may be rooted in expertise, it may be rooted in, you know, again, alliances that have been built. But in most organizations, if you don't understand that or come to understand it, it's going to be very difficult to get anything done. And so, and again, this sort of comes out of my background as a you know, someone who studies negotiation, diplomacy, you know, especially international diplomacy, you at a minimum need to understand, right? Who are the power players in this organization? Why are they as influential as they are? Whose support is going to be crucial? How do you think about building that kind of support? And that then gets you into things like, you know, the alignments that we talked about a little bit earlier. But putting on that political, you know, hat and looking at the organization through a political lens, I think it's absolutely essential because it's the reality. You know, I used to teach a course on corporate diplomacy at the Harvard Business School, and that was for MBAs, right? And so they're relatively early in their careers, and you know, sometimes they think that, you know, all organizations, as people go to the top, must become more rational and more sensible, and these people have such power. And I'm like, no, right? They become much more political because there are no right answers to the level of problem that those leaders are grappling with. And it really becomes judgment, but also alliances and support. And, you know, and a related thing that I would hear people say sometimes who took the course, they'd say, I hate politics. And my answer would be, get over it, you know, or be a fatality, you know, because, I have my little jokes about this, Deepak. I'd say, look, if you want to describe it as building alliances in support of getting important things done, if that makes you feel better, you know, by all means, embrace that framing, but don't kid yourself that you don't need to do it.
I was reading this book, Political Savvy by Joel DeLuca.
Yeah. It's a good book.
He talks about people's mental models, right? There is a group of people who see organizations as rational systems, mm-hmm. and there's a group of people that see organizations as people systems. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at some level, as you said, fundamentally any group of people together, working together, are going to operate more like a people system, right?
Absolutely.
And you need to know how to work that system. Yeah. And it's a mental model issue.
Yeah, I find, by the way, that it's the engineers that struggle the most with this, right? Because they have such strong technical systems training, and sometimes they're not as fully in touch with their own emotions, right? And so they can really run afoul of this sort of thing.
This segment reminds me of my conversation with Dr. Ramachandra Guha, a respected historian and a man who studied Mahatma Gandhi for several years and has written multiple books on him. When I asked him about how Gandhiji transitioned from South Africa to India, this is what he said.
Gandhi once talked about taking one step at a time. Mm-hmm. So he was an incremental reformer. You know, he wasn't a man in a great hurry. He wanted to understand a society, a system, before seeking to improve it or transform it. And his non-violence comes from that. His open-mindedness comes from that. And he comes back to India in 1915, spends a year looking around India, looks a little more. In 1917, organizes some localized satyagrahas. And only in 1919, after 4 years in India, he launches his first movement at an all-India level, the Rowlatt March. So that he has that sense of soaking in the country and its diversity, coming to grips with it before trying to change it.
Now, India is a complex country, and it can take up to 4 years to form a nuanced picture of what's going on before you start driving change. But you get a broad idea. Ensure that you understand the nuanced picture of the influence landscape in the new organization and win some small fights before you start moving forward and start launching a crusade. If you find the podcast of value, do rate and review on iTunes, Spotify, Google, or the podcast platform where you consume this content. Do also share it with leaders who might find this of value. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Professor Michael Watkins. And moving to the other challenge you talk about, Michael, onboarding challenge, mm-hmm. right? When leaders come into a new organization, I'm curious about the notion of decoding the culture, mm-hmm. right? Especially some of the hidden elements of culture, which often are not visible on the surface.
Yep.
So can you share your insights on what could leaders do to be effective in the way they decode the culture when they come into a new organization?
Well, I think the process has to begin before you even arrive, which is asking people through the process of recruitment about the culture of the organization. You know, what are the real rules of the game? How do things really get done there, right? What gives people influence? What sorts of, you know, behavioral norms operate? And you can, you know, you can get into a few little dimensions that, that help you think about this, right? One example is decision making. Is this more a consensus-based organization where you need to, you know, touch base with all the key stakeholders, or is it more a, you know, a more authoritative kind of model? Meetings are my favorite sort of, you know, as an anthropologist, right, as an organizational anthropologist, it's like the watering hole, you know, if you will, right, of organizations where you can observe a lot about what goes on in organizations socially and politically, right? So, you know, are meetings places where issues are openly debated, or are meetings places where understandings that have been reached in the meetings before the meetings are ratified, as an example? You know, processes versus relationships obviously are critical in terms of how you get things done. So it's things like that. You know, is it a culture that's more a culture of individual accomplishment, you know, star culture, or is it more collective? And there, you know, there are frameworks obviously that can help you think about this, but, you know, there's still no substitute for getting into the organization, engaging in that kind of observation. Sometimes it can help to find people in the organization that can help you understand what's going on. I think of them as sort of cultural interpreters, but there's no, you know, magic fairy dust here that can help you, you know, understand a culture instantly.
Of course. And you also talk about the trade-off between degree of adaptation, where the leader assimilates into the new context, and the degree of driving change,
yep,
where the leader asserts himself or herself in a new situation.
Yep.
Of course, it's contextual, but what have you seen leaders do effectively in walking the tightrope?
Sure. So I use a metaphor for organizational culture, which is I call it the organization's immune system, right? And like the human immune system, organizational culture is there in large extent to keep bad people and bad ideas from taking root. And so the risk, if you do things that are not cultural, you know, is that you will be attacked by the immune system, right? And that, and isolated, even digested, right? If you want to go with further with the biological metaphor. So unless you're part of a critical mass of people that have the power to change the culture, and that's a big if, right? Then in general, what I recommend is you become enough a part of the place to win the ability to change the place. And that means, if you continue using my metaphor, doing a reasonable amount to fool the immune system, right? And not trigger things before you've established some credibility, established relationships, built a mandate, right, with others to drive the change process. It's very different if you're part of a group of people that are really there, maybe being brought in from the outside to really drive change in the organization. But it's a completely different dynamic when you're in that situation. So the advice I give there is more about the kind of the individual coming in, right? And you know, there's organizations sometimes set people up to fail. And one easy way to set people up to fail is to bring them into an organization as, in quotes, a change agent, when there isn't really, you know, consensus that change is necessary. You know, and I mean, I have my little jokes about this again, right? So, you know, organization decides at some level intellectually, to your point, not emotionally necessarily, that change is necessary. So they hire a change agent, and the person comes in and, oh my goodness, they start trying to change things, you know, like, oops, you know, like, we weren't expecting this, you know, like, you know, so, and then, you know, the reaction begins. So I guess that's the essence of the advice. You know, but it is a trade-off, right? Because the other thing is, you stay too long operating by the way the organization operates, the risk is you won't really drive the kind of change that's necessary.
And maybe just trying to map it to a time clock, have you noticed any trends in terms of, let's say, leaders moving from observe and assimilate mode to taking calls mode? Is it 90 days, 1 to 12, or is it 6 months? Do you have,
you know, it's funny you said that, Greg, because I actually have never asked that question, Deepak, and it's such an interesting question. And 6 months just flashed into my mind. I can't tell you why I think that, right? But what I can tell you is 3 months doesn't seem like enough time to really have established a foundation sufficient to begin to drive that kind of change. How, unless, right, you're in a turnaround environment where you've got that scope to do it. You know? But don't try to hold me to 6 months. I'm not sure I can support it. It was just kind of a intuitive, you know, response.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. It's interesting to hear Michael say that it's arguably more important to earn the right to drive change before you start driving change, even if you have the right ideas that will move the organization forward. This reminds me of a podcast conversation I had with Ravi Venkatesan, who used to head Cummins in India and then transitioned to head Microsoft in India. Now, he wears multiple hats. One of them is UNICEF's special representative for young people. He speaks about how he thought about his transition when he took on the chairmanship of Bank of Baroda, given he had limited knowledge of the financial services world and public sector organizations.
As you know, that about 18 months ago, I took on a completely new role as the chairman of a public sector bank.
Right.
Now, I know nothing about banking, and I know even less about public sector. But yet, Raghu and Raghuram Rajan and Jayan Sinha felt that it was important that I take it on, so I did. Now, what do you do in this situation? And you know that the place is filled with landmines, and you can step on anything and without realizing it and get blown up. So, what you have to do is listen intently, and I did. I made it a very conscious effort to listen to a bunch of people, retired chairman of the Bank of Baroda. Okay, so help me understand from your perspective, you know, what I should do, what the issues are, how would you handle them?
Hmm.
You get a certain perspective. I went and spoke to Vagul of ICICI and PJ Nayak of Axis Bank.
Sure.
Even though they've been around and seen the evolution of the banking sector. I've met a lot of our own employees and so forth. So from this, you begin to piece together first the situation, and then out of that emerges a theory of change, which is, you know, what interventions are really going to make a difference, and who are going to be the important allies in this. If you don't listen and you start immediately, you come in with a point of view, you start, you know, jumping into action right away, you're going to make a lot of mistakes because you haven't built this nuanced and reasonably accurate picture of the landscape.
Piecing together the theory of change after listening to a range of people is critical before we start moving things around in the organization. Unless you're brought in for a turnaround where the context is different and there's a premium for early action. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Professor Michael Watkins. Got it. The other piece that got my attention as a past search consultant in my previous life was the notion of transition risk profiling, right? When a new leader gets hired and comes on board.
Yep.
What are some of the dimensions of risk that you think about when you think about transition risk when you have a leader coming in?
Yeah. So I think the starting point is to really at least think about that, right? Because it's pretty clear that some transitions are harder than others and create bigger risks than others. And if you acknowledge that, then the obvious implication is you want to provide more of the right kind of support to riskier transitions because, you know, you're going to reduce the likelihood of underperformance or failure. So that's kind of where I start with that thinking. And then you ask yourself, well, what makes transitions more or less risky, right? And one dimension I sort of fastened on, and it was the basis of the Master Your Next Move book, is how many distinct types of transitions are you going through? Right. So, you know, if it's just onboarding, that's different than you're onboarding and being promoted and moving your family to a new country. Yeah. So, and it's only a rough measure of risk, but how many distinct types of transitions you're going through is one way to think about it. You know, it's far riskier for an outsider to come into a realignment scenario than for an outsider to come into a turnaround scenario. So, you know, I just want organizations to be thoughtful, right? If you embrace the idea of accelerating everyone, including people making internal moves, then the next step to my mind is, think about providing more support where there's more risk. Again, I think that seems on the surface pretty logical, but then you need to operationalize that, right? How are we going to assess what kinds of transitions are more or less risky? And I just made a stab, right, with this, you know, kind of what mix of transitions you're experiencing as a way to start to think a bit more deeply about that.
Got it. And maybe just picking up on a specific trend that we see in India these days, right? We clearly are seeing a significant entrepreneurial activity. Mm-hmm. Bangalore, which is often considered as the Silicon Valley in India.
Absolutely.
Several entrepreneurs setting up businesses and several businesses coming up to a point where they are transitioning from a startup to a scale-up.
Mm-hmm.
There you have young founders often in their 20s and 30s bringing in leaders who are possibly in their 40s, you know, who've sort of been there, done that.
Absolutely.
This is like think about an Eric Schmidt coming to a Google or a Sheryl Sandberg coming to a Facebook.
Exactly.
And I find that transition quite fascinating. In your experience, Michael, what are some of the watchouts, both for the entrepreneur and for the incoming leader, given there's so much that's going on in that in that transition?
So first of all, you know, you're absolutely right that, you know, organizations do themselves transition between phases of development. And there's been some pretty good research on that, right? And the phase you're describing or the phase shift you're describing is, you know, startup to accelerated growth. When that happens, typically, you know, I describe it as kind of organizational adolescence, right? You kind of need to grow up and become more like your parents, but it's painful, yeah, to do that. And it means more structures, more systems. And that can be very painful for people who got into the startup world in part because they love the flexibility, they love the dynamicism, the breadth of everything that goes on. So, you know, one risk is that they don't make that transition. They don't understand that they need to do that. They don't bring in the leadership necessary to take that organization to the new level. Sometimes it's investors that force the issue, right, on founders, but sometimes it's not a possibility to do that, right? So I would start with it's the wise young founder who understands that they need to bring in people with that kind of strong operating experience to take their baby, right, and scale it into something really substantial. I think it's also the rare founder that can make the transition through those stages of development to the point where there's really a large global mature organization, right? And so sometimes it's about recognizing when you kind of want to step out because you're not going to be able to be effective in the new role. So that would be a couple of thoughts on the founder side. You know, on the more senior people coming in, right, what you want to be reasonably sure of, I think, is that you've got a founder and a board and others who are going to support what you need to do and not get, you know, angry or undermining in some way or want to do things, you know. And I, you know, for some reason, Uber came to mind, right? Where, you know, you can see, you know, a lack of maturity in leaders that really is undermining. And I think as someone coming in, I'd want to have confidence that this young person is going to understand and appreciate what I'm going to do with his or her organization.
Got it. Michael, just wrapping up, you know, I'm curious about your take on transition coaching, mm-hmm. right? While a good coach is a good coach, when you look at transition coaching experiences that have gone on well, mm-hmm. what are some of the elements of either the type of coach or the coaching process that stands out led to successful transitions? What's been your observation here?
Yeah, so I think they really are very different things, right? So I like to juxtapose transition coaching versus development coaching. And I think there's a very different set of skills required to do transition coaching than development coaching. And I think the process is very different. On the skill set side, you need coaches who can help the leader grapple with the business issues and not just the leadership style issues or the behavioral issues. So you may have someone who's a tremendous development coach, but doesn't necessarily have the depth of experience in business at senior levels to really help that leader grapple with some of the decisions that need to be made early on, you know, when they're taking a CEO role, right? So there's this balance of business acumen and coaching ability that I think is different in transition coaching than it is in development coaching. Now, you absolutely see people who do both, right? So don't want to say you can't do that. And then process-wise, you know, if you think about a standard development engagement, there's often some upfront assessments or psychometrics or other things that go on. And then there's, you know, definitions of goals. And then there's regular sessions where you're kind of working on these things. I mean, that's a caricature of the process, but you understand what I mean. Whereas transition coaching is much more intensive earlier, right? There's much more about putting in place pretty solid plans. It's, you know, I often spend full days with clients early on engaging in those sort of, that sort of thinking. So there tends to be more of a front-end load, I find, to the transition coaching process. And there's more structure in the process and more tools, planning tools in the process that I think is typical in most development engagements.
Got it. And just wrapping up, Michael, you know, you've been studying transition for several years now. What elements of transition are you curious about these days, mm-hmm. given your evolution in the space?
So more and more, I've gotten interested in the relationship between leader transition, team transition, and organizational transformation, and how they really connect with each other, right? I mean, I'm quite interested in executive team development these days because almost inevitably when you're working with senior leaders, you're very quickly working with them and thinking about assessing and transforming their teams. And that can often then lead to work in organizational transformation. So that axis is pretty interesting to me. I guess the other one is just more about transition is becoming so frequent now that it's virtually a kind of continuous thing. And so how do you put a system in place in organizations that helps accelerate that constant transition that's going on? So it doesn't become kind of just an occasional thing that happens, but it's part of the core culture almost to really, you know, speed up those many transitions that are going on. So that's a couple of areas I'm interested in these days.
Got it. Michael, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for appearing on this podcast and for your insights.
Delighted to do it, Deepak. So I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you. Hope you found this podcast purposeful. When I look at my experience as a search consultant at Egon Zehnder and now as a transition advisor, I find that there are three or four broad areas where organizations and leaders often get wrong when they think about transitions. Number one, they often see this as an HR problem and not really as a business problem. And I often say the real question to ask is, what's the business value at risk if the transition doesn't go well? I want to pause and repeat this. What is the business value at risk if this doesn't go per plan? And this should ideally include the time lost when the leader is here, the loss of business, the time, cost, and the organizational bandwidth, most importantly, in recruiting another leader, the loss in reputation for the organization and the leader, which could hurt over the long term. Number two, there's often a misplaced overconfidence bias, if I may use the term, when organizations recruit a leader. People often make the mistake of extrapolating the dynamics of romance into marriage, if you know what I mean. Without getting into too much graphic detail, you know the downsides of doing that. You recruit a leader because he or she ticks 8 out of 10 boxes, and the derailment happens because of the 2 out of 10. Number three, onboarding is often seen as a single person problem where the onus is on the person coming in to settle in. While the incoming leader is a key actor in the play, I'd like to believe that the hiring manager arguably plays an equally important role in ensuring that the leader settles well. Success often depends on the ability of the hiring manager to seek feedback on himself or herself as well to ensure that the leader settles in effectively. Number four, it's critical to adjust the settings of the transition clock when we have senior leaders come in. Most people see it as a 1 week or a 2 week exercise, but seeing it as a 6 to 12 month project would possibly be a better way of framing it to ensure that we set the leader up for success in the new context. For more content, please visit playtopotential.com where you have the content organized by speakers and by specific sub-themes around leadership, transitions, and careers. The curated playlist section enables you to scroll content across speakers by a specific theme that's top of mind for you. For example, you might specifically find the playlist Settling into a New Context relevant. To access this, please go to playtopotential.com, click on the curated playlist section, and within that, click on Transitions, and you will find this playlist Settling into a New Context. This has a range of perspectives. For example, Ravi Venkatesan speaking about how he transitioned from Cummins to Microsoft. Nanda Nilekani speaking about how he transitioned from Infosys to UID. Dr. Ramachandra Guha speaking about how Gandhiji settled into India before taking charge in the freedom struggle when he returned from South Africa, and more. If you want to listen to the podcast offline, the content is available on most podcast platforms like Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and more. Thank you for listening. Bye now.